Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I couldn't be better, Tim. Just a fantastic day. How are you?
Oh, I am doing well as well. Thank you very much for asking.
And I hope everyone out there is doing well.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I hope that goes without saying, for
God's
sake.
You know what? Yeah, I hope it goes without saying also. I really want to start this new year off, 2022. I think that's going to be my new thing. You're going to ask me how I'm doing. I'm going to say I'm doing great. And then I'm going to ask you how you're doing. And then I'm going to wish everybody a good day. I'm going to say, and I hope everyone out there is having a good day. That's my new thing. So get ready for it.
You won't do it.
No, you're right. I'll forget.
Well, Lance, in this episode, we have on an old friend. It's James Renner. He's an author and journalist. He has covered a lot of cold cases, missing persons cases, notably Maura Murray's case. And he's got a new podcast called True Crime This Week.
And he also reinvented the definition of gumshoe during this interview. The actual definition is quite boring, so we're just going to go with his definition during this interview. If you want to look it up, you can look it up, but I'm telling you, it's boring.
And make sure to check out Renner's nonprofit called The Porchlight Project. And you can find info about it at porchlightonline.org. So check out The Porchlight Project. He's doing a lot of great things over there. And James is still covering the Amy Mahalovic unsolved murder. And we get into that a little bit.
We also really run the gamut here with topics that we cover with James. And that just kind of shows how multifaceted our relationship is with him. We don't really stay on one particular topic for too long. We cover school shootings because he's got young children. Tim, you have young children, and that just came up in the course of this conversation. It's something that's out there, and it's really interesting what he has to say about it, especially his son's experience and what's going on in his area with preventing school shootings and how that's being approached. I thought that was a really surprisingly fascinating part of this conversation.
Yeah, it's always interesting talking with James Renner, and I hope you find it interesting as well. Check out his new podcast, True Crime This Week. There is a link in the show notes, and there's links to follow him on social media as well.
And just because James is doing that podcast doesn't mean that he stopped doing Philosophy of Crime. That is still out there, so you can check him out as well. Philosophy of Crime is his other podcast. And when you go to the Porchlight Project's website, that's porchlightonline.org, you'll notice that it says major funding provided by the Audio Chuck Endowment Fund. That's Ashley Flowers' company, Audio Chuck. And I think that's just such a cool move to have an endowment fund to see people in your industry appear in your industry. She's a podcaster and an advocate, and she has a massive following, and it's clear that she's doing the proverbial talking the talk and walking the walk. So just a quick shout out to her there. She also donated to Private Investigations for the Missing, Bruce Maitland's nonprofit. So I just wanted to give a quick thank you for that as well. Really generous. And again, it's always refreshing to see people doing the right thing with the influence that they have.
All right. Big thanks to Ashley. And thank you very much for listening, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. James Renner, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm zooming at you from the 1950s, and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate. How are things going there? Oh, I see Lance is on the Kubrick set from 2001.
Nope, just my attic.
Oh, okay.
but yes, I would like to be on the Kubrick set from 2001. But hold on, we need to address you zooming from the 50s and how you have you've committed to this character. You've committed to the lovable gumshoe.
Well, yeah, my wife said I really should be committed, and so you know, wait, but I think I might have misunderstood her what she was trying to tell me. But yeah, anyways, no, I'm in the mode. I gotta get into the gumshoe mode so that when I'm done, I can take it all off and put on a nice cozy sweater and be just, you know, James, Vitamin J, instead of James Renner gumshoe.
Vitamin J. My goodness. You must be all caffeinated today. I don't know what is going on.
I feel like I'm super caffeinated right now.
It's funny. I did just down an entire Coke in the span of about 5 minutes.
Nice. Well, caffeine's my favorite drug. And
James Renner's my favorite drug.
Oh, yeah.
Where does the term gumshoe come from?
It goes back to the early days of yellow journalism, where in order to tell if a reporter has done their job, they come back to the office and the editor checks the bottom of their shoes for gum, knowing that they went out and beat the streets. I'm joking. I have no idea. But doesn't that sound like it should be?
That was exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, no, I have no idea. Yeah, somebody look it up.
Sounds really gross, though. So many people dropping gum on the street.
There's nothing else to do back in the day.
James Renner, please tell us about your new podcast, True Crime This Week.
What if I just said no? What if I'm like, no, I'm not going to, not at all. True Crime This Week, yeah, I've had the philosophy of crime now for a couple of years, and I do just a season, which is 6 episodes once a year. So it's fun to have those 6 episodes, but then people wanted more Renner. And I'm like, I should give it to them. You know, so I started thinking I've got all these opinions. If you follow my Twitter feed or my Insta or my TikTok or my Repod or what have you, my MySpace, I'm constantly commenting on the true crime that's in the news. So basically, I just wanted to make a quick cash grab and bundle that all into a prepackaged show that comes out every Friday morning, so that when you are getting up to punch in at the factory in the flats of Cleveland on your way, you can pull up the podcast and you'll get all the big true crime news of that week coming at you in my dulcet tones. And so I do updates on the top 2 true crime stories. We do updates on what happened in cold cases that week. And then there's a part where I get into the genetic genealogy, because genetic genealogy is solving new cases every week. And I try to keep it kind of light, kind of fun, and as much as you can with true crime. And it seems to be doing well. It's off to a good start, better than philosophy of crime at the beginning. And just seeing where it goes and having fun with it so far.
That is super impressive. You were right, though. The world needed more James Renner, and you were very gracious to spread yourself so wide and vast.
I waited a long time. I waited for the right opportunity. And when Silk City Hot Sauce came along with a sponsorship, I'm like, all right, I was waiting for Apple, but you know, we're gonna do this. Let's roll.
Googling Silk City Hot Sauce right now.
SilkCityHotSauce.com. I've got a coupon code. I don't know what it is, but if you listen to my podcast, it's on there. They have various flavors like Sweet Heat or Mango Madness. So it fits, I think, a little bit better with true crime than like, you know, those old, I don't know if they're still with you. Is Apron still with you?
No.
Oh, fuck them then. Okay. It works. It works a lot better than that, I think.
Well, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting, I really like getting back into something kind of newsy. You know, one of my favorite jobs was working as a reporter at Scene, and, you know, being able to see news develop and it changing every week, and getting back into news a little bit, even if it's just to kind of organize these top stories is a lot of fun, because you see how quickly things change and how weird things are. Because from week to week, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. And then, you know, something comes out of the blue, like the Gabby Petito case, and becomes this huge thing. And then 2 weeks later, we move on to something else. And it's equally as weird. People, they will find new and clever ways to commit crime. And it's bizarre. It's an insight into humanity a little bit. Not all of it's bad either.
Where do you get your news headlines? Where do you get your news updates? Do you have just multiple alerts that you've programmed to get emailed to you? And if so, what are your keywords?
You know, that's a good question. They come in from all over the place. Honestly, one of the reasons I thought to do this podcast is people started tagging me on weird crime stories on social media, mostly Twitter. And, you know, people send me links to Reddit and it's like, hey, have you seen this? And it's like, oh, why? I have no outlet for this. Why? I mean, it's interesting, but a lot of them come from, you know, other people I know. I'm on Reddit a lot, as you know, and some odd stories come through that way. And then, it's pretty easy to see, you know, what's trending every week. I try to make this a podcast, not just for the States, but for the world, Lance, for the world. And so, you know, at the top of the podcast, I see these are the top true crime stories in the world. So I'm also reading The Guardian out of the UK and Australia, and checking Der Spiegel for news out of Germany, and Sudoku, the big newspaper out of Japan. So I'm just trying to figure out what's the cool, big, interesting crime stories of the week.
And how long has your new show been on?
It's been going since October 15th. And it should be, you know, true crime this week. If you like and subscribe, you'll get it on your phone or device Friday mornings for your commute into work, if anybody's commuting anymore.
Well, tell us about the Porchlight Project. Any new cases, any new solves over there? You know, we're in this heated competition over solves. We've got some for private investigations for the missing that we've come very close at, and some we can't really talk about yet. So I think we're at about 100. What are you at?
I mean, you know, that was very early on. I lost count at some point. We've had some very good luck starting out, and we are doing really well right now. We're one of the cases that we're looking into is this young man who was found in a barrel in Cleveland in this like construction site or this abandoned like little factory back in 1969, a young African-American man. And he, you know, they found him in this barrel, which, you know, we're pretty sure it's murder. And nobody knew this man's identity all this time. So Porchlight Project is funding new DNA testing and genetic genealogy. The DNA testing's already been done, and we got some data from that, which the genetic genealogists are right now trying to use to locate a family tree. And we've gotten far enough where we think we found members of his extended family. He's got a very unique bone structure to his face, a very unique look, and these people have that as well. But it's been difficult to get people to open up and kind of hear us out. You know, you call somebody up in like rural Georgia and say, "Hey, do you happen to know we're looking for this man, member of your family who was possibly murdered, you know, 50 years ago," and they tend not to. You know, they're pretty suspicious of that. So we're getting very close on that one. And we also just took on another new case that I'm very excited about, just because of the weird, so many weird like coincidences pop up, and you've got this like, you know, people call it synchronicity or whatever. But a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Copperhead Island that opened up with the discovery of a young woman's body who had washed up on the shore of Lake Erie near Sandusky, near Cedar Point out here, which is a big amusement park. And that kind of kickstarted the mysteries of this book and the search for the truth. Well, this case kind of came to us, and it's a young woman's body who was found washed up on the shore of Lake Erie near Cedar Point. I mean, it's the exact opening of my book. And the body was discovered on March 30th, 1980, which was my birth date. You know, I would have turned two that day. So it's like, you know, the universe is saying this is the one you got to go for. So we just got that one, and the sample went to the lab, and they're testing for DNA. I'm sure we have the DNA. I'm sure we'll have that. So once we have the data, you know, go to the genetic genealogists, and I think we'll have an answer on that one pretty soon.
When did you write the book? And you said it was Copper Island?
Copperhead Island. It's the sequel to Primrose Lane. It's just sitting on a shelf somewhere. And Primrose Lane has gotten close to being a TV show, and it's being kind of revamped as a possible movie. So long story short, I'm waiting for something to happen with the TV thing before we release the sequel book. Eventually, Primrose Lane will be a trilogy, and with Copperhead Island being the second book of that trilogy of weird sci-fi true crime type of novel mystery.
And the actual body was discovered in 1980. And do you plan on using elements of that for part of the trilogy now that that's in your world as a reality?
Yes, I absolutely will. In my story, I'm not going to spoil it because you learn fairly early on, but you find out that the young woman is from Ukraine and she had come off a super secret private island on Lake Erie that's owned by like the one percenters, you know, of the area. And they hire Eastern European women on student visas to run the island and do things that whatever they want them to do in the summers. So, and that's kind of loosely based off like some real things that go on these private islands on Lake Erie. So if it turns out that she came off this, you know, one of these private rich islands, then I'll start getting really creeped out.
Interesting. You had mentioned those islands a while ago in a conversation. Can you elaborate just a bit more on those?
If you're from around Northeast Ohio area, you're familiar with the islands on Lake Erie. There's Kelly's Island, which is where you take the family, and there's like a place you can camp and see the old grooves that the glaciers left behind. And then you've got the Party Island, which is South Bass Island, and there's Put-in Bay there, which is where all the college kids go to drink and have a good time. And so you've got South Bass, Middle Bass, and then North Bass. Those are some quieter islands. But if you're on South Bass and you look west, you'll see another island. And you ask the people that live around there, you're like, hey, what's that other one? How come I can't get to that island? And they're like, oh, that's let me tell you the tale of Rattlesnake Island. That's when you learn that it's a private island that was originally owned by the Catholic Church, kind of creepy. And they used it as a summer camp up until like the 70s. And then around like late 70s, early 80s, around this time, this body shows up. I'm not saying there's a connection. There's not going to be a connection. But this group of private individuals bought up the island. And in order to become a member of the Rattlesnake Island Club and get access to the island, you have to first pay the $93,000 initiation fee. And then there's a yearly fee to remain there. You can buy and purchase a house there if you want. There's just a little bit of room. There's always been rumors that that's where like some of the old mobsters went to retire and to kind of lay low. And they've got this, and they do hire young women from Eastern Europe on student visas to run the restaurant there and to bartend and to do hospitality during the summer. And they don't really let these young women off the island. They have like a 24-hour off time between Saturday and Sunday, I guess. And they have to pay their own way, like off the island if they want to go for a couple hours. So it's kind of weird. It's creepy. You know, why are, you know, one reason you'd want to staff your island with people from another country is so that nobody goes back to the mainland and talks about what happens on the island. So I've always been interested there. It's mostly lawyers and real estate developers and things like that. But it did used to be used as a stopover for bootlegging back during Prohibition, where they were running liquor between Canada and the States.
Very interesting. Tell us about Amy Mihalovic's case. You had mentioned that there was some new stuff going on in that case.
So they came out with a new piece of information on the anniversary this year, which is October 27th. That's when Amy Mihalovic was abducted back in 1989. So now we're, what, 32 years into the mystery. Remember, a couple years back, they brought out this kind of avocado green curtain, and it had been found about 100 yards from where her body was found way back then. And they were never sure that it was connected to her case. So I wish they would have come out with that information back in 89 or 90, but they waited because they weren't sure it was connected. But then they found a sample from the curtain had a hair from a dog. And one of the FBI agents from back then was smart enough to collect samples of dog hair from the dog that lived at Amy's house, like the household pet, and it matched. So that's when they first realized about 5 years ago that this curtain was definitely related to what happened or was most likely used to wrap up her body during transport. but still they weren't 100% sure. So the little bit of new info that came out this year was that, yes, in fact, we tested the curtain again. This time we found Amy's hair on the curtain. So 100% definitive, this curtain is part of the mystery. So they brought it out again and asked people if they recognized this odd curtain. It's a narrow curtain. What makes it especially odd is that it had started out as a bedspread that had been used, that somebody had hand sewn and repurposed into a curtain. So, who would know how to do that? I mean, she was found out in the country where you kind of repurpose a lot of material and people grow up, patching pants and, with old beds and things like that. So I've always found the curtain particularly interesting for a couple reasons. I've got my top suspect. There's a guy that I think remains on the list for everybody who was a former teacher, and he had an alcove in his science classroom where this narrow curtain would have fit just perfectly. And we went back and looked at pictures from the late 80s of his classroom, and it's hard to tell, but there's a similar shaped curtain there. And you think who would have had the experience to sew it, right? And before this guy was a teacher, he worked as a seamster. He worked sat at a sewing machine all day. So I think that's a particularly good clue. I think that case is still going to rely on some of this new DNA technology. I hope that they're utilizing the new tests in genetic genealogy, but they keep things real, real hush hush over there.
And when you say we, you said we looked at pictures from the 80s of his classroom. Mm-hmm. Who's we? Is it, you have a team of people or?
No, I just mean that the people online that follow the case. I still run a blog for the Amy Mihaljevic case where I update, periodically, not as much as the Maura Murray case or anything. People still go on there and comment. And so it's just, the people that follow the case online.
Cool. And I think that's important to note is that when you're saying we, you're talking about the community online that is following and trying to contribute in a positive way, in a respectful, responsible way. How closely do you work with these people? Is it like email, phone, text?
Yeah. After writing the book, just like, with True Crime Addict, I wrote a book on the Amy Mihaljevic case a few years before that. And that kind of makes me the lightning rod for information. So it's not quite as organized as the people that follow the Maura Murray case. I'll get emails weekly on the Mihaljevic case. And every time there's a little bit of new information or a new suspect that pops up, the people that know about that will go online, they'll Google, they'll find me, and then they'll send me the info. So whatever the police are getting, I tend to get like the next day or vice versa. I'll get something and then I'll send them to the police. So I'm kind of, when something happens in the case, I get a heads up and sometimes I'll write about it. A lot of it, just like the Murray case, as you've seen, over time, it just becomes noise and, the same things being repeated over and over and over again. It's like, did anybody, she got calls at home. Maybe somebody should run, let's go back and run the phone records. And it's like, well, first of all, you're talking 32 years ago. Secondly, I'm sure that's one of the first things they did. And third, technology's changed so much that back then all you were able to figure out is that whoever was calling Amy at home was calling from a local number because they only logged the long distance at that time. 90% nothing new under the sun, but then probably a couple times a year somebody will send me something and it's like, oh my God, this is a great tip. Maybe this will shake something. So far it hasn't quite been enough.
And what's your interaction like with the family, with Amy's family? Are you still communicating with them?
I still see them, so I do library talks around here, especially in the fall, about all sorts of things. I wrote a book on local myths and monsters and legends. And so like around Halloween time, I'll do some library talks about that. And I went out to Grafton in October of this year, and there was a woman sitting in the audience as I got there. And I'm like, oh, she looks really familiar. And it's Amy Mihaljevic's father's wife, you know, that he met after she passed, and he remarried. So she, yeah, they still keep in touch and show up at my events every once in a while. It's nice to have that interest and support from a family that you've written about on one of these cold cases. You know, it's very different from, you know, I've only ever had the one bad experience, and it's that one that never goes away. They're great. And hopefully, you know, one day we'll have an answer for them. I remember, you know, the one thing I come back to a lot is Amy's father. After one of these library talks, he came up to me and he's like, "Hey, you want to just come back to the house for a cheeseburger?" And nobody's ever invited me to their home just for a cheeseburger before. And I'm not one to say no to any of that. So I went back to his house and we hung out in his kitchen, and he microwaved me a hamburger. They must have had it like the night before. It was really good though. And we just sat around and talked mostly about stuff that had nothing to do with the case. You know, talked about his grandkids and his house, and you know, somehow we got around to the topic just a little bit, and the idea of closure came up, and he's like, you know, after all these years, he's like, there never would have been closure. And what he said was closures for buildings, not people. Closures for doors, not people. We never really have closure. He's like, what I want, and now he's older. He's like, what I want now before the end is, he just wants to know, you know, he just wants to know. And that would be enough for him. Even in, you know, I don't think he would necessarily even need to see somebody behind bars. He just wants to know.
Yeah. Interesting point about closure. Yeah. We've had some conversations about this and kind of feel like it's tough. I don't know. Even the word justice is kind of weird to me sometimes. Like, I don't even mm-hmm. know what justice means sometimes.
Right. With the Amy case, you know, what is justice in that case? Even if they find the guy at this point, he's been free for 32 years. He's not going to live. Whoever it is not going to live another 32 years if they're still alive today. You know, so they've already been free longer than they could possibly be put in prison. And the thought I had when I got really wrapped up in that case was, in this case, I think justice really could just be getting the person in court, having them stand up and answer some questions about the case, even if they don't get a conviction, because, you know, there's enough that circumstantial evidence that you could indict somebody, and you could indict, you know, there's some good suspects in the case, and one kind of stands out above the others. And maybe that in this case, that's justice, you know, where everybody kind of knows. And maybe I wouldn't want them to indict anybody that's innocent, but if they have definitive evidence in their mind, that could be it, is just getting that person into the courtroom.
And do you think that the person went on to commit other acts of violence after Amy?
I don't, which is what makes this case a little different. I think this, and this is this is not just something I came up with. This is an opinion that's shared by many of the FBI agents that worked the case. It appears that in this case, this person, it's a one-off where it appears what happened was this person definitely, you would suspect, has a history of being inappropriate with children, but not necessarily violence. And I think, you know, what some people think in this case is that he arranged this meetup with her. He was calling her when she was home alone, saying, "Hey, I work with your mother. Why don't you meet me? She just got a promotion. Meet me at the shopping center on Friday afternoon, and I'll take you to go get a present for her. It'll be our little secret." And so he had kind of come up with this way to get this girl in a car. And I think he didn't know what was going to happen after that. I think he thought that maybe there could be some sort of like relationship there or something. I don't think necessarily that murder was the intent when she was picked up. When you look into how she was killed, a blunt object on the head likely knocked her out. And then she was drained of blood by two incisions in her neck. So it seems kind of unplanned. And I think they didn't do it again. I think because you can't find, there's no other cases around Northeast Ohio, at least, that match up with the same MO. There's no other unsolved murders of girls Amy's age and location, and especially that weird way of luring her with the phone call. So it's, you know, we're looking for, you know, it's really hard to find a killer if they only do it once and manage to get away with that one. So, you know, most of the top suspects in the case are men that had the means, motive, and opportunity, and had this history of being inappropriate with students or kids. So it's a strange case. Otherwise, it would have been solved, you know.
Right. Are some of the suspects still alive?
Yeah, all the men in my top, you know, my top three are still alive. There have been a couple in the FBI's top 25 list that they keep. There have been a couple of those that have passed away, a couple suicides in there that are suspicious. There's also the possibility that we're looking at a weird crime here where, you know, there's more than one man involved in the crime. And the more that time goes on, the more I consider that a distinct possibility. Because one of the ways that some of the top suspects could have gotten by all this time is, you know, one of them alibied the other out for part of it. You know, so the abduction, you know, one guy abducts her, but the other guy is the one that disposes of the body. So they both kind of have alibis for part of it that seem to rule them out until you consider that maybe they work together. Once you get into those top suspects, you kind of see how they overlap. You know, they were frequenting the same creepy places, and they most likely knew each other. Not to get all satanic panic, but you know, I think it's definitely a possibility. There's a very new, you know, back in January or February this year, the Bay Village police got really excited about a new suspect, and they got you know, the local news found out that they had subpoenas and were issuing subpoenas to search storage spaces. And you know, in this 32-year-old cold case murder, that's a pretty big deal. So, you know, who is this new suspect? And it, you know, they haven't published his name, but, you know, again, when that story broke, people came to me with, and they're like, okay, we know, here's who it is. And eventually I figured out who this guy was. And I was trying to figure out why the police were so very interested in this guy. One of the main things that pops up with this guy is he was living in Bay Village at the time. And then Amy's body was found like an hour away in Ashland County in the middle of nowhere. And the day that her body was found, this is like 2.5 months after she disappeared, the FBI wrote down the license plate of every car that passed by the crime scene. And when this new suspect popped up on their list last year, they ran his license plate and found out he was one of the cars that drove by the crime scene. So it's like, what was he doing down there at that moment? And so that was telling. And then I just kind of, you know, I was thinking about it more and more. And then I looked into where he's from. Even though he was living in Bay Village, he was going to school at a different place, I'll say. And it was the same school district where my favorite suspect of all time happened to be teaching back then. So they totally would have been close to each other. They would have known each other. I've been told that they worked together, that, you know, he helped them out in the classroom, but I haven't been able to verify that yet. But it's weird that, you know, this big new suspect that's on the police radar was so close to the guy that I've been looking at all these years.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors. And now we're back to the program. Yeah. And, you know, two people working together, my gosh, that seems really dark. And it also just seems difficult to make that transition. Like, if you see this person at work or at a bar, like, how do you go from that to, you know, help me with this? And then let's
never do it again.
Yeah, not do it again and not talk about it.
Well, I think in this situation, it was a, let me talk about it this way. There's another case that I looked into in Akron years ago that was the subject of a story I wrote called The Serial Killer's Apprentice. And it was a similar deal where there's the serial killer operating in Akron, and there's a lot of circumstantial evidence to suggest that he was training his nephew in the practices that he was doing, that his nephew was at least aware, maybe even, you know, how complicit we don't know, but he was trying to train this kid as a serial killer. And so one way that something like that can happen is through grooming. And, you know, eventually you have almost like that, that thing we talked about before, the idea, the folly I do, where you get close enough to somebody and you break those social paradigms down, and suddenly what's not normal, it feels normal. And they can operate together. And that certainly happened in the Akron case, and could be something that we're looking at with Bay Village as well.
Yeah, just because I can't figure out how that can happen in my head doesn't mean that it doesn't happen in the real world. Grand scheme of things, I'm pretty innocent.
It's probably good that, you know, you can't figure it out in your head, right? Yeah, to a lesser extent, I think you see some of that in like things like The Tiger King, you know, where he's got these young men doing his bidding in exchange for, you know, favors and meth and, you know, hanging out with the tigers. It's that same weird grooming until, like, you know, what's up is down and down is up type of thing.
Speaking of that, I was looking through your latest episodes of True Crime this week, and I noticed that you spoke about the Jussie Smollett case. Let's hear some thoughts on that, because that is very up is down, down is up.
Yeah. Poor Jussie Smollett. You know, he had it all, right? He was on one of the top shows on TV, Empire, and he had his career was rocketing. And it seems as though he had this thought, well, maybe I could just punch it up a little bit and, you know, get some street cred by getting beat up in Chicago. And he comes up with this idea to, you know, what he said happened is that he was walking around Chicago and a couple of guys in MAGA hats started yelling racial and homophobic slurs at him and then beat him up. And so he went to the police and it became this big thing. And like, you know, everybody, all the celebrities commented on it, you know, justice for Jussie. And then, you know, if you've seen the Dave Chappelle special, I think he tells it better than anybody else, because he's like, you notice that, you know, that he didn't comment on it. He's like, I thought he was guilty from the very beginning. And once you start looking at the details in his case, it really does start to fall apart. The police, I don't know what he was thinking, because the police obviously are going to look into this. And one of the first things they did was track down the men involved in this alleged assault. And it turns out these men were African-American too. And you're not going to find two African-American men in Chicago wearing MAGA hats assaulting somebody. It's just not like, it won't happen. First of all, I don't, you know that they would even wear MAGA hats. And so all these questions started popping up, and then eventually it leads to this big trial. And I don't know if what's funny is there was all this media attention. It was treated almost like a murder case, right? But really, he was just charged with, what was it? Like felony counts of public disorder or something stupid like that. Like once you really got down to like what he was even charged with, it's like, buddy, why did he even take that to trial? You knew you were guilty. Just take the fine, take the probation. Don't, you know, but it became this whole media thing. And he stuck to it to the very end. What was interesting in the Jussie Smollett case too, that you're seeing more and more in these cases, like with what happened with Kyle Rittenhouse. So you're seeing these defendants take the stand, and that, you know, I don't know how that is changing, but, you know, until very recently, you never saw defendants on the stand. You know, they have nothing in their favor for that. There's nothing they can win by going on the stand other than getting grilled by the in cross examination. So, but Jussie took the stand, and, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse did too. Jussie is an actor, so maybe he thought, you know, I can just charm him. I can charm that jury. And it just didn't work out for him. So who knows what'll happen. I think anybody can come back. You know, it's possible he could, you know, look at Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr. didn't do anything quite that crazy, but you know, he was constantly getting arrested, and now he's like one of the big stars. So it would be great to see a comeback story from that guy. So his next chapter will be interesting for sure.
Yeah, weird choice. The whole story, obviously, the whole thing, the MAGA hats, really unnecessary, bringing politics into whatever he was trying to accomplish, I guess.
Right.
But I guess it was just, you know, media anyway, sort of a bizarre publicity stunt that went way wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like a Coen Brothers movie. You know, you start out with the best intentions and then everything goes horribly awry. And it makes it 10,000 times worse for you, buddy.
And was it because of that that you decided to cover his case in a couple of your episodes? You know, just that like storytelling angle to it, that Coen Brothers storytelling angle where it just kept folding into itself in the worst ways?
Yeah. You know, I'm fascinated by stories like that where, you know, people are, what fascinates me about, you know, crime in general is how, okay, two things. One, it's very rare. Like the chances that you're going to get caught up in a murder investigation or some serial killer is going to throw you in the trunk of his car. I mean, they're so small, you shouldn't even be worried about it. We hear about it all the time. We talk about it. We have podcasts about these things, right? But the only reason it's interesting is because they're so unique. You have a better chance of getting crushed by a soda machine than you do of getting abducted by a serial killer. With the Jussie Smollett thing, you know, and these crimes that I touch on with True Crime This Week, it's really just watching the trends. And it seems like, you know, for whatever reason, it probably doesn't say something that great about humanity in general, but we kind of need, it seems, a case to be concentrating on it at all times, or people get a little antsy. So they move on to the next thing and the next thing, like the Gabby Petito thing. Everybody got their energy out for that. And then, you know, it ended in such an anticlimactic way. Nobody was happy. And then, you know, the Kyle Rittenhouse trial came around and people had something to talk about again. So, you know, I like going for the ride and learning what it says about us at the same time. What I try to do is remind, as I'm reporting on these stories, as I'm talking about these topics and big cases, is try to remind people, you know, what we should really be focusing on. You know, and I've done, unfortunately, I've already reported on 3 or 4 school shootings in the 10 weeks that I've been doing this. And what I try to, you know, I don't just talk about them for the salacious details. In fact, a lot of the times the details of what specifically happened, I leave out, because what I want to talk about is why we have AR-15 style assault rifles anyways. What do we need them for? They're not for hunting, not animals anyway. They're intimidating. They're, you know, for, yeah, I want people to reconsider, you know, gun laws and, you know, the bigger picture behind these things, because nothing's changing. You know, the only thing that changes is the location of the school shooting. We're not stopping these things, and it goes on and on and on. And, you know, I'm not big enough to have an effect by that. But, you know, if I can get 10 people to look at it a little bit differently or think about it in a different way.
I'm torn between saying it's an inspirational thing and it's one of the saddest things I've ever experienced is seeing the reaction of the kids who have gone through these school shootings, especially when you see the videos that they'll take during the school shootings. And the latest one that happened when the children were taking a video with their cell phones and the shooter was trying to get in, and how the kids handled that. Did you see that video? How the kids handled that?
Yeah.
It was amazing.
They were weirdly calm, right? And, you know, one, and they're like, okay, who, you know, and it's the police or somebody outside. So it's the good guys. And, but these kids have been trained and, you know, so they're like, okay, who is it really? And he's like, and the police officer said something flippant, like, dude or whatever.
Yeah. He said, bro, I think.
Yeah, bro.
He said, yeah, it's cool to let me in, bro, or something.
And the guys are like, he said, bro, it must be the shooter, you know, and so they're diving out the windows. And, you know, there's so much, I mean, such an American problem, too. You know, the fact that the kids were trained enough to like remain calm in that situation frightens me a little bit. You know, Casey is now in high school out here and they still have the Alice drills, which, by the way, they started those things without explaining to the parents what was really going on. But, you know, they teach the kids out here that, you know, during these school shootings, that you, if you're in a certain situation, you engage with the shooter, that you throw desks and chairs and things at him and you try to tackle him. Like, my kid didn't sign up for that. You know, I've told him if he even hears a gunshot, I said, you jump, you know, you're getting out of that building and, you know, just running as far away from that school as possible. I don't, like, we have something ingrained in us, I think, in this country where we want to be that hero and we want to be ready in that situation so that we can be the next John McClane and save everybody. And that just, I think, breeds more incidents like this because there's more guns out there and it's disheartening.
It really is. And just, you said it's a, you know, it's an American problem that we have. And I can't even handle how many times people will, I hate the phrase triggered now, because like you can't even have an emotion about something without someone calling you triggered. Like you can't do it. But yeah. you see these like Twitter posts from, you know, representatives, Thomas Massey, who sends out this Twitter post of his whole family posing in front of the Christmas tree or whatever. All of them have these weapons and they're not like handguns. These are like AR-15s and yeah. they're significant weapons that they're all holding. And it says something like Santa bring ammo for Christmas or something like this. And that happened just days after the school shooting that we just talked about. I mean, completely tone deaf. But if you bring it up, then you're triggered. Mm-hmm. Then you're the one that just can't handle, you know, you're trying to be too politically correct. Or you're trying to, you know, stifle somebody's Second Amendment rights.
Yeah. I mentioned this in a recent podcast, but you know, there was this major case out of Australia. I think it was like 15 years ago now or something, where they had this mass shooting where I think 15 people were shot and killed to death before they apprehended the shooter. And you know, what they did was they changed the laws in Australia and it hasn't happened again. And in Australia, you need to show a specific reason to have and own a gun. And it can't just be because you think it looks cool on a Christmas card. It has to be because you have an infestation of wallabies on your property or something. You have to have that specific need to get rid of something. And, you know, here we have something like Sandy Hook. I really thought Sandy Hook would be the turning point because it was an elementary situation and little kids. It just didn't change a thing, you know, and it's happened. You look at the numbers on these things, the shooting this past week was like, I think the something ridiculous, like the 30th school shooting since August. And it's nuts. We're our country is insane, full of crazy people.
Yeah, and I don't understand how it becomes a political argument. You know, this is about safety of children, for God's sake. You know, kids whose parents believe in both sides of politics.
I mean, the answer's obvious. We need to start arming the children. I mean, that's the only way we're gonna be able to start. We've already armed the teachers, and that didn't stop it. So we got to arm the kids now.
Well, I mean, if the kids were real in the first place, these are crisis
right.
actors.
Of course, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Oh my God!
Oh,
we're
boy.
On a sinking ship. We're yeah. rearranging chairs on the deck of the Titanic. It's been lovely working with you guys, but that's where we're at.
Well, okay. Speaking of the Titanic, are there that? This is a terrible segue. I apologize. Are there any future James Renner live shows that we can look
oh,
forward to?
Great. I want to. You know, it depends. Like, I'm waiting to see what happens with COVID. And, you know, whether or not that's something that I can really do and get people out for again, as soon as it's clear, as soon as, you know, I want to get like, I've done the East Coast, I've done West Coast. I want to do like middle. I want to do like Denver and Las Vegas and, you know, around there. I love those live shows, getting up there and, you know, mixing comedy with the, you know, stand up and true crime. And it was amazing. I can't wait to get back, you know, but I'm still not entirely sure, guys, that this isn't the beginning of the end, you know, that, I mean, not to be a downer, but, you know, people, you know, they, I'm here in Akron, and Akron General, they just parked this big trailer out next to the hospital because the morgue's full. And how surreal is that to say it? It sounds like it's like that scene from Ghostbusters, you know, where, you know, Ray and Winston are driving in the car and he's like, the dead are coming back. And it's like, we're in the end times. It's like, well, we got a tractor trailer pulled up to the hospital because there's too many dead people. I definitely went on a rant. What about you guys? Are you guys going out on the town anytime soon?
No, we're right there with you. I mean, we had there was a glimmer of hope, and then, you know, we're getting taken over by a new variant. So yeah, we got to buckle down again. You know, we got to hunker back in the hunker in the bunker is what I was going to say, but didn't realize it was going to rhyme.
Hopefully CrimeCon in Vegas is still goes off without a hitch.
Yeah.
You know, in 2021, the spring and summer seemed okay. So I would expect that again in 2022, I guess.
Are we going to play some slots when we're down there? Are we going to hit
We're going to smoke cigarettes and get a tattoo and play slots.
You know what? We should plan a heist. You know, it should be that it'd be the last people they'd expect, that the true crime podcast hosts pulling off the best heist at the casino.
Heard it here first, folks.
Shh. It'll be a secret though.
I do have hope. You know, you mentioned CrimeCon, and you this is something that'll be happening in the early mid spring. By that time, we know they're working hard on boosters and vaccines, and if people will understand the repercussions of not taking a vaccine based on last year, based on the last like 16 months, 18 months.
Yeah.
No one wants the economy devastated again. No one wants to not go out. No people. I would love to go to the grocery store without a mask on, but I'm not going to do that. You know, eventually it'll come back around. So maybe the whole end of days, maybe you're not accounting for the response to it.
I wish I could be that optimistic. I went out and purchased. I have a box of seeds in the basement in case the shit hits the fan. That's my insurance clause. At least I'll have kale and carrots as the world burns.
I'm moving right to Svalbard.
Where's that?
I got to make sure I just said that correctly. Svalbard is like up past like the Scandinavian peninsula.
Oh, yeah,
it's the
yeah.
world's
Oh, where
they have all the seeds there.
Yeah. Oh, that was a good reference. I like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Svalbard. Yeah. Global seed vault.
Well, that I think that must be where like your people must be hail from there somewhere. Aren't you Scandinavian?
Yeah. My little Swedish flag right here.
There you go.
Yeah. The reindeer stars.
Thank you.
Well, no matter what, you're always welcome for a cheeseburger at the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown.
I like mine with lettuce and tomatoes, Heinz 57 and French fried potatoes.
And microwaved.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me on. Anytime I can return the favor, I can't because I don't have guests on my show. But but we should hang sometime. You guys should come out to CrimeCon UK next time. And
we'll love it.
On you know, we'll take a lorry down to the lift and have some bangers and mash. I don't know. I've lost it.
Do you know why they call them bangers?
No.
Oh, well, because back in the day when they needed to ration food, they would inject their sausages with water to make them seem bigger. So when you fried them, when you put them in a pan, they would pop.
Oh, interesting.
Done.
Now I know.
Also, the origin of gumshoe is so boring.
Gotta bring
it's
it back
so
around.
Boring that we're just going to go with yours.
Okay, great. You heard it here first, folks.